Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Emil Heskey, former England, Leicester, Liverpool, Birmingham, Wigan, Villa, Newcastle Jets and Bolton forward.
Emil, I wonder how you look back on your career and how it went for you. Is it something you look back on with great pride?
Yeah, it is. When I get to see the 100 Premier League goals and all that on Sky, so
yeah.
I can look back and set with fond memories and say I achieved a fair bit, you know. Coming from Leicester, winning things with Leicester as well, which was amazing. Considering we was favoured to go down, as every team that comes up into the Premier League is favoured to go down.
Yeah,
we actually stayed in top half of the league table and went to three cup finals.
Yeah, amazing. And you started your career as a very young player, really, didn't you?
Yeah.
What was it like making your first team debut at 17 for Leicester?
It was. It wasn't as daunting as you'd think, because I was a lad that was. I was helping out in the changing rooms. I was in and around the first team, but I was training with them and then going with the youth team, back with the youth team, but then traveling sometimes with the first team just to see what it's like. But I'd be the one that would be making the teas, picking up all the kit after helping the kit man and stuff like that. But then that day at QPR away, about three or four of them fell ill.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, and no one had said anything to me or anything about that. So I was actually the only forward that could play.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay.
And imagine him ripping back the paper just to show the team, and I'm playing up front.
How did you feel?
I didn't have much time to get nervous, because it was literally, they do that an hour before the game.
Right, okay.
Or an hour and a half or whatever it is before the game. So just got changed, went out and played. It wasn't, we lost 2-0 QPR away. But it gave me a little insight on where I needed to brush up on.
Was it hard then?
Oh, yeah, it was tough.
Was it noticeably tougher than the team, the training you'd had?
Yes.
You've been training with the first team already, right?
Yeah, it was. Training, you can't replicate the games, the intensity and the pressure being on a pitch against an opposition that you don't know, kind of thing.
Hmm.
So that is different. But I knew that I was capable of getting up to speed very quickly.
Is it something that, even when you started playing football as a young kid, had you always grown through being stronger, essentially one of the strongest players all the way through? So it was something you were used to, basically.
Yeah, definitely. At 15, I was playing under 18s.
Yeah, for what, for a professional club?
For Leicester.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, at 16/17, first team.
Right,
I'd kind of outgrown my own age group from a young age. I was a big lad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you grew up really, really
quickly.
Young.
Yeah, quickly. At 16, I was adult size.
Right, okay. And following season, of course, you became more of a first team regular, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
And made 30 odd appearances, I think, in that season, and then started the playoff final as well.
Mm-hmm.
How do you look back on that season? Is it something that you, because it feels to me, looking from the outside into your career, that all of a sudden you're just away. So you start that debut in March, mm-hmm. and the following season you're there, you're a first team regular, and you're away. And you never really look back after that.
No, Martin O'Neill came in. I think we'd played Norwich at home, and he'd obviously seen me play a few games, and he was Norwich manager, but then I think he resigned that day, and we were looking at getting a new manager in. David Nish was was the caretaker manager alongside Steve Walsh, actually.
Yeah.
I scored one and set up one. We won 3-2 that game, and then it just spiraled from there, really. I played most of the games after that, and then when Martin O'Neill came in, he just spoke to me and said, look, I've seen you play, all I want you to do is this. We had big forwards, so I wasn't really going to play up front, so he played me left or right.
Mm-hmm.
But I was quick, so all it was, he used to say, get the ball, turn, take him on and cross the ball.
Yeah,
and that's what I did, and we managed to get to the playoff final.
Yeah. You got a good memory for the games you've played then?
Some of them, no.
It's funny because I speak to a lot of different type of players in here, and some of them can remember everything to the minute, and some have absolutely no. You essentially feel like you're telling them what they did. But you've got a good memory for big stuff.
Yeah, most of them, yeah. Apart from the, when we go further on in the career, I speak about it, the UEFA Cup final.
Right, you can't remember that. That was a blur for everyone, I think. Wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a crazy game. I watched it back, and then you start to say, oh, yeah, that happened.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Well, come
on, like,
we'll,
that was like 60-something games in that season, though.
Yeah, exactly. You did play a lot of games that season. You mentioned Martin O'Neill there. I wonder if you look at him as being certainly one of the most important people in your career.
100%.
Yeah. What did he give to you that you feel like...
The confidence to go... I was confident anyway, but the confidence to go and actually just perform and not overthink things.
Yeah. Did he break it down to quite simple things? Simple.
Everything was simple. If you were good at heading and... If you're a defender, you're good at heading and just clearing it. They'd say, that's what I want you to do. Blah, blah, blah. And you'd be just like... And then you'd be praising you doing the simplest of things that you're good at. So you want to go out and play for him. He wouldn't ask you to go and drive with the ball into midfield and start distributing it here and all that what you can't do.
Yeah.
So for me, all he would say was, I just want you to get the ball, turn and run.
Yeah.
And that was what I was good at.
Yeah.
And that was what I grew up doing. So it was simple for me. Get it, turn and run. Just do it.
So he didn't overload you with information or anything like that?
No. And at that time, it was great. At some stage, you need a bit more information and need a bit more to know a little bit more about football. But at that time, it was brilliant. I was only 18 at the time.
Do you think you're... Because I've spoken to players in here where they've said, one week I was just asked to play right midfield and I never played there before and I wasn't given any education or coaching on how to do it. Do you think that a lot of top players, they just are expected to learn it as they go and pick it up and just crack on with it?
Back then it was, yeah. You learn.
You don't think it's like that now?
Nah, they want every bit of information now. Right now, that you need to know. You need to know everything when you're on the pitch, and that's why I believe that's why some coaches struggle a little bit Not so much the younger ones, to be honest, because they've grown up in that in that environment now. So they know that they need, the players need everything. They're looking over at you to, whereas before we'd have to figure out certain things on the pitch, whether you're pulling someone in, whether you're telling someone to stay further up, the senior pros would be figuring all that out for you on the pitch, or you'd be figuring that out yourself. And but now it's that's the manager's job to be telling you and pulling you here and telling you to stay out there, or telling you to stay up, or dropping you back deeper.
What do you prefer as a player?
I obviously, when I first started out, I preferred a little to no information at all. Just let me go and play.
You want to play on instinct, basically. Yeah. You get out there on the pitch and you want to do what you feel that's natural for you to do.
Exactly. But then as you get older, you want to learn. You want to learn. And that's where, when I went to Liverpool, Gerard Houllier was brilliant. I speak about it in my book, that went from really doing no prep for the opposition. When I say no prep, we weren't sitting in meetings looking at individual players for an hour or whatever it is. Then going to Liverpool, and you are doing it in a pitch black room with a screen on.
You think some players just couldn't handle that? Can't deal with it? Can't take it all in?
I've seen it before.
Yeah,
I've seen it before, but at the top end, no. They like that information.
They know it. Yeah, they can learn it easily.
Yeah, yeah, they like it. They like to have that information, all that information coming in.
But Martin was much more in the Brian Clough mould of kind of, don't worry about them, we'll do our thing and we'll be fine.
Exactly, exactly. And it worked. It worked at Leicester. Yeah. We, like I said, we went to 3 cup finals in 4 years.
Yeah.
Finished top 10 every season. So something was working.
Yeah, absolutely. I wonder, because you say in your book, I think, that at one point Martin gave you quite a big telling off after a game, which upset you, basically. You still hold him in great fondness now. Do you look back on that as just being something that needed to be done, and it was fair at the time?
Yeah, it was.
How old were you at the time, though, Emil?
I'd have been, what, 18, 19?
So you were young.
Yeah. But the thing is, football's not always nice, so I don't expect people to be nice to you all the time. You need to, as they say, kick up the backside sometimes. I don't think I needed it then, but he gave it and I took it. And
you respect it looking back on it?
Yeah.
Because I always come away from these interviews thinking that it's a real man's world, football. Like, you have to, and I'm not talking about with respect to the men's or women's game. I just mean in the world you guys operate in, or operated in, you're expected to almost be quite a well-rounded, serious, mature adult at a very, very young age.
Yeah, 100%. It is tough when you're going into that environment as well. If you're not, and we've seen it, we've seen players struggle a little bit. And if you're not ready for that environment, it can eat you up.
Do you think we've lost players who would have been brilliant had they been treated differently?
Put it this way, I know players of my age. When we were growing up, they were the best players.
Better than you?
Oh yeah.
But they didn't get have a career?
No. And I know players from down here, because we used to play all over the country because of our county football. And I know players from all down here that were top players. And you can say that if you say some certain names to people who have played the game from my age, if you say certain names, they'll say, yeah, he was a great player.
But they just didn't have the mental toughness.
I don't know what it is, but it just consumes them and they don't make it as far as us.
And how much of what you've achieved has come down to hard work, do you think?
All of it.
It's training ground, hard work. Because we hear about players who aren't particularly great trainers but still have good careers. But
the thing with that, I don't buy into that, to be honest.
Really?
No, I liked training. I liked training a lot. Putting in the hard work in training ground. If I wasn't as good as others, as in the running side of thing, I'd work on it. But I knew what I could do. Now, if you've done it on the training pitch Monday to Friday, Saturday should be easy. If you put them that hard work in, Saturday should be easy. You can't. I've seen it, and the biggest one was Romario. For me, I'm a real big fan of Romario. Partying, going out, blah blah. And then turn it on Saturday. Yeah. Not everyone can do that.
No,
majority of people, you've got to have done stuff during the week that when you get to the Saturday, it's easy.
So the tiny fraction of players, you, Romario, Ronaldinho, George Best, they can get away with it, but most of us aren't no. those people, are they?
No, no, definitely not. You know, I always say that you train the way you play.
Yeah, okay. And when I was thinking about talking to you today, I thought to myself, what type of player, you know, were you? And I came to the conclusion that ultimately, and it, when I thought about this, it all fell into place. Ultimately, you were just a really, really team-focused player, right? Mm-hmm. So, and you've said in your book, and you called the book Even Heskey Scored as a little joke, but mm-hmm. you said in the book that you didn't really care whether you scored or not. Now, I know strikers who would secretly be happy the team wins, don't want the person playing in their position to score because they want themselves to play. You're saying that, honestly, hand on heart, if you went through your career or through a season scoring two or three goals, if you won trophies, that's all you cared about.
Yeah, I didn't mind. It was a case of I always looked at team first. Yes, and I've done that from a young age. So yes, you want to score goals. Yes, and I, like you're saying, I know players that if we win 3-4, 5-0, and they haven't scored, they're fuming.
Right.
Why? We've won.
What do you make of that then?
It's personal, isn't it? It's selfishness. But again, strikers are selfish.
Yeah. So it's for you. It's all about winning things and the team. And so you judge your career on trophies, then, do you?
Well, yeah. I what I achieved. Yeah.
Okay. And it wouldn't matter to you if you didn't. You didn't hit the back of the net, really.
Does it matter? When you got the medal there, so sure.
No, I suppose it probably wouldn't matter to me. No, but that's the thing. There's always chat about you'll see a game and you'll see a striker and he'll take on a chance when he should have passed it, and people will say, "Oh yeah, but as a striker, you need to be selfish." But surely a player should make the right decision in the right moment.
It's about making the right decision. Now, if he misses that chance, if he scores a chance, everything's fine, isn't it?
Yeah.
But if he misses that chance, then what?
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. and I also read that. Your assist record in the Premier League is right up there with Paul Scholes.
Yeah.
Who Paul Scholes is seen as this great, and obviously he's a great player.
A wonderful player.
Yeah, but amazing. The stats are incredible, aren't they?
Yeah.
In that case. You're being very humble, but I think it's worthy of a mention.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Look, I work for the team. That's what it's all about. At the end of the day, you take the rest of the players out and put certain players in. Put 11 players who only think about themselves.
Yeah, see how far you get.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why coaches like to buy you. That's why Michael Owen likes to play with you.
I think as well, when you look at teams like Atletico Madrid, who probably weren't highly fancied at time, but Simeone put together a team that work for each other, that are hard working for each other as well. Mm. But then you have a few individuals that give you that little bit special.
Yeah.
And that works.
Yeah.
Works so well.
So you mentioned earlier, didn't you, that you went and played at Liverpool for Julier, and that was around 2000, wasn't it? Start of 2000, a lot of money. Were you thinking about the transfer fee at the time?
Never. I didn't think about it. I just wanted to play. That was their problem, in the sense that I never made that fee up. They agreed that fee.
You had no say in it.
I had no say in it, to be honest with you. So you just get on with what you want to do, and that was all I wanted to do. I wanted to play for the club.
And you love Leicester, but you thought Liverpool was a move not to be turned down.
I think, look... I'd come a long way with Leicester. I'm from Leicester. I was actually a Liverpool fan.
Okay.
But I'd come from under nines with Leicester, from the age of nine, with Leicester, and enjoyed every minute of it. But I'd come to a point, a crossroad, where I'd thought, what do I do? Do I stay another year? Do I stay another 2 years? Because I know they wanted me to stay, obviously, but I'd felt that I'd done enough. I'd won trophies with Leicester. We'd been to 3 cup finals. I'd played a prominent role in all of that. So I just thought, what's next?
It's the next step for you.
Yeah, what's next? And that was the next step.
It's very similar to how we had Chris Kirkland on the show, and he talked about Liverpool fans as well, but obviously grew up through Coventry, and he just thought, I think he came a year after you, I think,
yeah.
And he said that, you know, I felt like I needed to make the move.
Yeah.
Did you have an agent at the time?
Yeah.
You did, okay. So I remember Chris saying he didn't have an agent or anything like that. He just got on with it.
Yeah. Did he?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But the agent takes care of all of it. You're not focused on any of the attention around the transfer? Because I remember it being quite a big
move. It was a big transfer. Yeah. But I, like I said, I had nothing to do with that. Yes, in a sense that I'm the player. But apart from that, I just wanted to play. I didn't care about all the talk or about the transfer, the money or anything like that. I just wanted to play. And that was my thought process.
And do you go into that team and think this is a much bigger deal than Leicester? Is it noticeable that it's a different club?
Yeah, 100%. At Leicester, it was We had good players, by the way. Muzzy, Neil Lennon. Players
they were a great team, that Leicester team.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
But then you're going into another level with Liverpool playing at Melwood, training at Melwood, and the likes of Robbie Fowler, Michael Owen, Jamie Redknapp.
It was another level again, was it, training and stuff?
Yeah. And the training at Leicester was good, but it was we wasn't allowed to tackle at times because we obviously the manager wasn't happy with certain tackles going in.
Yeah.
But then at Liverpool, 3-4.
Was it?
Oh,
you think it would be the opposite? Yeah, you think there'd be a lot more protective over
there? First training session, Stefan Ancho, bang, straight through the back of me.
You weren't expecting it?
No. No, because I was come from a place where you don't get tackled.
Yeah.
You can do, but it's not like you could do whatever you want, but... You know, them sliding tackles from behind, no.
Not in training?
No.
Until you got to Liverpool, where it happened all the time.
Yeah. And you just get used to it. But it's good because it puts you on your toes and you're ready for the game.
Yeah. And was the debut something that sticks in your mind?
Yeah, no. Right. It was Sunderland.
Yeah.
We beat Sunderland when I was at Leicester 5-2. I think it was me and Stan. Mm. Stan scored a hat-trick. I scored one. Then went to play them for Liverpool. I won the penalty. Michael was injured actually.
Right.
So I won the penalty and Paddy Berger scored and then Kevin Phillips scored for Sunderland.
Sunderland, yeah.
Yeah, and 1-1. Finished 1-1.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Your first full season. Well, the following season you were there, you scored quite a few goals actually, didn't you?
Yeah.
Over 20 goals and how does that feel now? Because you have I think brilliantly and very humorously, you've called your book Even Heskey Scored as a reference to people singing that song and we'll come on to that. But you scored over 20 goals at the top level that, that 2000-2001 season and we know what happened. Again, you're a cup finals player by the sound of it because you won another three cups. There's no bitterness at all that people don't rate you as a goal scorer to the point of where you've called that book, your book
I'm,
that.
I wouldn't call myself a goal scorer. People don't rate me. Managers picked me.
Yeah.
So
that's all you care about.
Yeah. People don't rate me. The thing is,
I meant people don't rate you as a goal scorer.
Yeah,
I'll
I'll give you a funny story. I've said it before anyway, but I had a bloke come up to me and said, what is it? Oh, how you doing, Husky? Blah blah blah. Yeah, great player, but you didn't score enough. I looked at him and went, okay. But I scored over 100 goals in the Premier League. He went, did you?
Right.
I went, yeah. He went, oh, I like rugby anyway.
What are you going to do? What can you do, right?
There you go.
So you think it's a marketing thing. You haven't been marketed properly. People don't know enough about it.
There you go.
People need to go and watch 100 Premier League goals on Sky Sports.
There you go.
And throughout, I mean, you were at Liverpool for a while and you scored, I mean, what is it, 60-odd goals? Mm-hmm. I mean, people see the headlines,
the thing
don't
is,
they?
I didn't play up front all the time either.
No.
I played on the wing a lot as well. I played every position. I played left wing back for Leicester once.
Yeah. Team player. And around that, and towards the end of the century, of course, before you went to Liverpool, you made your England debut as well. Mm-hmm. Fond memories for you?
Yeah, wonderful.
That's the ultimate thing, is it?
Yeah, definitely. I was lucky enough to play the youth levels, so you get a little taste of it.
Yeah.
And then went on to play the full international and I'd be picked by several. I was told six managers.
That's not a coincidence, is it? Yeah. That's no coincidence, that. And I think of you as that striker in between Shearer and Rooney.
Yeah.
The three years or so between, I know you came back later on, but the 3 years between Shearer and Rooney. Yeah. And that was a team. I mean, I know England are doing well now and everyone's excited, but that was a team full of quality players. Mm. I mean, to be fair to you there, you're not going to get in that team if you're not decent, given the amount of players they had at their disposal then.
And I'd played with most of them at youth level as well. So
you knew them, yeah.
Yeah, I knew a lot of them. It was good times to be playing in that. And everyone talks about the golden era, blah, blah, blah. And but the thing is, you've got to remember France had their golden era as well.
Yeah.
And we played against them. It's funny. If you go back to England under 18, my England under 18s, me and Michael up front, he was 16. We had Rio, we had Lamps, we had Michael Bridges, we had all these players that you can name and you think, oh, yeah. But they had Trezeguet, they had Henri, they had Anelka, they had Saha, they had William Gallas, they had Mikel Silvestre, they had Ousmane Darbo.
Yeah. Yeah, and they won World Cup and the Euros. Exactly.
After, then you add Zidane into that, you add Petit into that, you add Vieira into that, you add Lizarazu into that.
Yeah. It's pretty special. Did you go into, I mean, a lot was made of that England team. Did you go into every game thinking we can win this?
Oh, yeah.
Every game?
Yeah, 100%. And the thing was, the confidence was super, super high when it comes to qualifications.
Mm.
But then when you get to the tournaments, I don't know what happens, but it doesn't feel the same. Mm. The tournament never really felt the same, to be honest with you. The closest I felt we got was the Brazil game.
In 2002. Yeah.
And I felt, yeah, this is our time, but after that, no.
Is it, what do you put that down to in 2002? Just bad luck?
Well, you're playing against three Ballon d'Ors, aren't you?
Sure. But they had, I mean, they played large parts of the game. England played really well, and were well worth it, you know?
Yeah, we did. And that's why I say it looked like it was the best possible chance we could have had. Mm.
Yeah, I think you need a lot. You need a certain amount of luck to win a tournament anyway, right?
100%. You do need your luck. You got to ride your luck every now and again, and I'm guessing they did it.
Yeah. Do you think it's changed now in the England setup?
As in
the feel around it.
Yeah. You see that the feel looks great, and they can control the narrative at times when putting things out. It looks great on social media. I like it, to be honest.
Yeah,
with you.
Same.
So and then the fans can have a little feel for it, whereas we were kind of isolated a little bit.
It was a very different feel, wasn't it? And it felt also like in between every tournament, if it didn't work, they would tear it up and start again from the beginning with a completely different manager, whereas now there's a bit more of a
bit more consistency with sticking with someone now. But I think that's because Gareth has had a lot of these kids and Gareth knows the system from within. And the FA are happy to keep him,
let him do it.
Yeah.
What do you think? 2001 was your best year?
Goals, yeah, but I still feel I played probably better football at Leicester.
Really? Okay. Because you won all those trophies 2001.
Yeah.
And you, and the famous
2001. Yeah.
Yeah, and the famous England game.
5-1.
Yeah, that was 2001 as well.
Yeah.
It was a pretty special year for you, no?
Yeah, it was. Everything just clicked. Obviously, early 2000. Well, the 2000-2001 season, the full season was something that just was special. And then obviously accumulating in winning the League Cup, then the FA Cup, and the UEFA Cup, then the Super Cup.
What are your memories of that game against Germany?
Just being 1-0 down, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah. And then I spoke to someone recently and he goes, oh, I remember where I was. I actually went to the game and he said that he was supposed to be on the halfway line, but he said he refused to go there. So he stood behind the goal with all the England fans.
Really?
And then I said to him, yeah, but what was your thoughts when we were 1-0 down? He goes, oh, shit.
Yeah, you can swear, carry on. Yeah, do what you want. Yeah.
I was shitting myself.
Really?
Yeah. And he goes, yeah, but no, look, we won 5-1 for you. So
yeah. Do you remember that slot on that goal in?
Yeah.
You can remember it like it is now.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So when you go out on the pitch and you say you're presented with a chance like that for England against Germany, I know the game was won, but it's an important goal to score for England against Germany. Mm-hmm. Are you in that moment, or are you just operating on instinct at that point?
In a sense, what you mean in the moment?
So when
are you thinking about the
what you're thinking of what you're doing, or is it all instinctive?
I'm thinking about what I'm doing. I was thinking, make sure I have a good touch.
Yeah, okay.
Which I didn't have.
Okay.
But it wasn't fully underneath my feet, but it was a little bit underneath my feet. But I just thought, keep the ball low.
Yeah.
And into the corner stuff. Yeah.
And the celebrations after was pretty good.
Yeah. As in after the game.
As in after the game, yeah.
We had another game.
So you couldn't really do much.
No.
You just treat it as any other game.
Yeah, that's what we had to.
Yeah, but there wasn't even a special moment where they just said that you can have a beer or whatever.
Nothing.
Not at that level, you can't do that.
No.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Like, even when we won the treble with Liverpool, we won that game and then the Birmingham game.
Yeah.
But then we've got another game to play.
So you beat Birmingham in the League Cup and Arsenal in the FA Cup. That was when Owen scored two goals, right?
Yeah.
And then Deportivo Alaves.
Yeah.
Okay. I just thought that you, maybe I'm being naive here because I wasn't a professional footballer, but that you wouldn't be able to resist having a quick glass of champagne.
It's different levels, isn't it? When we won the League Cup at Leicester, there was nothing stopping us from that. But when you're at Liverpool, it's a different type of
mindset
and professionalism,
and that counts through to England as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the air in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
I remember reading, Emil, that not long after that you were linked with a big move to Spurs.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any truth in that? Did you ever feel like you were in control of where you wanted to go, and you didn't really mention that you wanted to leave? And it was
no. I don't know about the Spurs one. If I'm honest with you, Spurs one before I went to Liverpool. Yes.
Okay. Right.
But not while I was at Liverpool.
Okay.
I don't know that one, to be honest.
How do you as a football player? How do you approach or deal with transfer speculation, and how did you used to behave if you were unhappy at a club, for example?
The good thing for managers, if they could, is actually explaining to you what's going on.
Yeah.
Some managers don't, some do.
Mm-hmm.
Because the last thing you want to know is that you're not welcome.
Sure.
And because when I was at Liverpool, when I left Liverpool, they came to me and says, "Oh, they've accepted a bid from Birmingham.
Yeah,
you're free to talk." And I thought, "Well, I'm happy. I've got one more year left. I'll fight for my place." Because now Cisse's coming in, and you won't play.
Mm.
So okay, I'll have to go then.
Yeah.
So that was it.
And you're simple as that.
Yeah.
Because you come across as quite a laid back character, yeah. So you wouldn't worry too much about it.
No, I didn't worry too much about it. The thing is, where do I stay? Do I stay somewhere where they've already told me I'm not going to play?
Yeah, but some players might want to prove the manager wrong and double down and say, "We're going to stay."
Well, I did say that I'll fight for my place.
Yeah.
I said, "No, you're not going to play. Cisse's coming in."
Right.
So if someone says, you're not going to play.
What can you do? Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you appreciate the honesty?
Or
were you annoyed at the time?
Annoyed at the time, but you know, it is what it is. You move on.
Yeah, and so Birmingham were the team that you fancied going to.
Well, they were the only ones.
Were they the one that came
actually,
in?
Actually, sorry, tell a lie. I'd spoken to AC Milan at the time.
Really? Yeah. Tell us about that.
It was just a weird phone call that come out of the blue, and spoken to AC Milan, and nothing come of it, and I was at Birmingham.
But would you have fancied that move?
Don't know. I'd always wanted to play in Italy, but at that time, mentally, was I ready to go abroad?
What were you at the time, 26, 27?
Yeah, 26.
Okay. And why did you always want to play in Italy? Because you grew up watching that on TV and stuff, same as me.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, are you 41 now?
Yeah.
So you're similar age to me. Yeah, I was found Italy on a Sunday morning or whatever, watching
there
it on
you
TV.
Go.
Yeah.
David Platt.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Gascoigne and all the rest of it.
There you go.
Would you have adapted living in another country, do you think?
Probably, yeah. By then, yes.
Yeah.
When I was younger, no.
I was really interested in Denver Barr the other day, saying that he would advise any black player not to play in Italy now. Because of the problems. Because of the problems over there, yeah. Would that have been in your mind?
No. It wouldn't have been back then, but yeah, I understand where he's coming from, because there's a recent one talking about a presenter saying certain things about...
Just broke, exactly.
About Lukaku.
On Italian TV, yeah.
Which is weird, because it was just like it was norm for him to just come out with that sort of stuff. You're like, oh, okay. Italy have a lot of things going on that they'll have to sort out.
Which it's crazy that you would even have to consider that to go and do your job somewhere else, and that would have to be a factor, right?
Yeah.
But that's the reality we live in, sadly.
Yeah, 100%.
Is it something that is racism from fans or from fellow players ever something that came into your world as a player?
I wrote about it in my book when we were younger, playing a youth team game against Stoke, and me and the lad up front were getting racially abused by the defenders.
Right.
And he knocked two of them out.
Did he really? Yeah. Okay. After the game or during the game?
No, during the game.
Right.
He made a tackle, and one of them, obviously one was on the floor, and then the other one come over, giving it, but yeah.
Racially abusing.
Yeah. So he gave him two, he fell, and then the other one got up and he gave him two again and he fell.
Blimey. What did you do?
I just stood there watching it. Yeah.
What was your? I mean, it's sad that you'd ever have to deal with it. What's your approach to dealing with it when it manifests itself?
Apart from that, I never really had much on the pitch.
Not even away for England or anything like that.
No, I mean on the pitch.
Okay.
I'm talking like from opposition. We had a little bit in international youth level and stuff like that. And then it was usually from the stands, Slovakia away, I think it was.
Right.
And it's funny, I talk about it again, and ball comes to me, we kick off, I have the ball, play it to someone in here, boo.
Right.
Then it goes to Beck, stops, goes to Ashley, boo.
Boo again, yeah.
And then it goes back into Scholesy or goes to someone else, and then it comes back to me, boo.
Mm.
But then after a while, you're like, oh, I understand what they're doing. I didn't realise they were actually making monkey jokes.
You just thought it was booing.
Booing, yeah. But we'd only just kicked off, and I think, I haven't kicked anyone yet.
No, okay, right, yeah.
Let me kick someone first before you boo me. But then you realise what they're actually doing, and we talk about it being education and everything. So it happens more across, and then Croatia as well.
And what would you advocate? I mean, do you feel like you had a support network in place at the time to be supported by the England team at that point, or
in what sense?
Well, just that people acknowledge that it's happening.
Give you an option to leave
or whatever you want to do.
They never gave me an option to do anything. But after the game, things were reported. I had to give a report.
Hmm.
I had someone come to the house and basically give a sit down and talk to me about it and what happened and everything. So you give a report to FIFA.
I remember one of those incidents. Weren't they fined £15,000 or something ridiculous like that?
I don't think that was my thing. I think that was a bit later.
Right, okay.
A similar
incident.
Yeah.
Do you advocate players leaving, just walking off the pitch?
I understand where they're going with that, but I don't think so. I would not like to walk off the pitch because that's my domain. You don't dictate to me coming off the pitch.
Sure.
You lot leave.
Okay, yeah. So you don't want to give any quarter, basically?
No, this is my pitch.
That's fair enough. Okay.
So I don't, but I understand where they're going with it. What will stop them from doing? What will make the most impact on them? And that's probably, they've come up with leaving the pitch.
What do you think is the best course of action then?
The thing is, we had it with Croatia. We're talking about punishing the fans.
Yeah.
Really and truly, when England played Croatia in that empty stadium, who was punished?
The
England fans.
Jadon
Sancho's parents.
Yeah.
Because he's made his debut that day, and
in front of no one,
they can't be there.
Mm.
The fans that were standing up on the hill having to scream from there.
Yeah.
They're the ones who were punished, not the people who were thinking. That had nothing to do with the England fans. It wasn't even the game that they played.
It's a tricky situation, isn't it? It's something you feel that's got to come from almost from outside of football to educate people to be.
Education is a big thing on the broader aspect of things, but football itself. If you're having a full stadium, do it. How do you actually? pinpoint out certain people and saying you're not coming back in, or we don't want this in the stadium, blah blah blah. Yeah. Do you have a full stadium of England fans?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I believe Italian, a lot of Italian clubs have invested in facial recognition technology now, and they're starting to punish individual people.
Okay,
that's the kind of the future of it. But then people are worried about, you know, having your face everywhere when you're just going about your day type thing, and it's a little bit invasive. But I suppose if desperate times call for desperate measures, maybe, and that's what's got to be done. I mean, ultimately, people shouldn't be racially abused at their place of work. I mean, or anywhere, you know, it's as simple as that. But you would say in the Premier League and in England, it's generally been a lot more positive.
In your experience? In my experience, I haven't experienced anything like that, to be honest with you, in a sense of being abused like that on a football pitch or anything, so...
Okay, fair enough. When you moved from Liverpool to Birmingham and Mill, are you conscious of the idea that it's hard to go anywhere from Liverpool in terms of the size of club?
100%.
Did you feel it was a bit of a gamble to move on to a club?
No. I backed my ability in that, and I was very confident, but in saying that, I found it very difficult because I'd gone from playing with Stevie.
Mm.
Gary Mack,
yeah,
Michael Owen, Robbie Fowler, players like this. Then, no disrespect to the Birmingham lads, I go into the change rooms there, and the players that I used to play with, they were three steps ahead of the players that I'm going to.
Yeah, so you have to adjust your game.
Oh yeah, 100%. I went from making runs and people before I've even made the run, they know I'm going to make it. Playing into feet, wanting it back, blah blah. And then I'd gone to making runs, no one's even looked at me.
Right.
Gone to ball going sideways and backwards a lot. So I had to adjust my game again.
Did you find it difficult to adjust?
No. I found it difficult at first in the sense that I didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
At first. And then I had to figure out where I fit and how to play within that system. And then it was fine after that.
And was the management and the coach were decent to help
you?
Yeah.
Steve Bruce was good. It was all about fitness when it comes to the smaller clubs. You've got to be extremely fit because you're not going to have as much ball.
That's
as
interesting.
Them.
Yeah, because you're not going to see the ball as much, right? But now we're seeing teams kind of go for it, aren't we? Like the smaller teams. Like, I mean,
Everyone wants to play the same way, don't they? Now, everyone wants to play out from the back, and no one wants to be really hitting channels and stuff like that. Everyone wants to play similar sort of way to
Pep.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you were kind of you were the hold up man, really.
Yeah.
Bringing other players into play.
My game changed over the years. I was a hold up player, and at first I was one who runs the channels. And then it changed to being a typical number nine where you're holding the ball up, flicking it on, bringing other people in, creating chances for others. It changed throughout the years.
Is there any resentment? Not resentment, but any kind of comment from you on that's seen as a kind of an unfashionable way to play now, isn't it?
What do you mean, playing back to front?
Yeah,
but they still need it because at times you do need to go back to front and you do need to have an understanding of where to be as a forward as well.
But Pep's never going to want his forward.
No. He'll always want to. Because you see Raheem playing up front, don't you?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Well, occasionally teams would play without a striker at all.
False nine. He played with it at Barca, didn't he?
That's right. Yeah. But because I think a lot of managers, for example, feel like they've now been rendered like obsolete or out of fashion because it's not a way that perhaps a chairman would want his team to play because the fans wouldn't like it now because of the way the game has changed.
I'll be honest, the fans would just want you to win games.
Is that what you think that's the sum total of all of it?
At times.
Yeah.
I've seen it where fans have been calling, oh, better football. No disrespect, Stoke.
Yeah.
Now, Tony Pulis was there. They were cemented in the Premier League.
Yeah.
Want better football. Yeah. Want better football, want more attractive football. Now you think, now they'd be happy to just be having, being up there just winning games.
But they're bottom of the championship at the time of recording, so it's not ideal.
Yeah.
Do you think if you came through as a player now then, do you think you'd still be a striker?
Yeah, I'd still be a striker. I'm very good at adapting to different surroundings, so I'd just adapt.
Simple as that. You get through it. And do you think the game has moved on in terms of education, nutrition, training since started?
Yeah, 100%.
Does that play into your hands as well? Are you always a fit lad?
I was generally a fit lad. Nutrition wasn't something that came in until later on in my career because it was just wasn't there. If you were doing it in the early '90s, early 2000s, you were ahead of yourself. But now it's norm. It's the norm to be super trim, having your diet down to a T.
Yeah.
Stuff like that's the norm now.
Yeah. But that didn't happen when you were starting out.
No.
But they take an interest in what you're eating, how you're looking after yourself. They didn't at all.
No, not when you first, you know.
No.
No.
And so, but as you move through your career, it was something you thought about more because as you got older.
Yeah, you've got to look after your body a lot better. You're thinking about recovery as well.
Yeah.
I never thought about recovery before.
No. Just get on with it.
Yeah, exactly.
And as you sort of, I know you did a lot more, you've teamed back up with Martin again at Aston Villa and you did a lot more through your career, but as you get older and you see the end of your career sort of coming down the road, is it something that you think a lot of players struggle to think about because of the routine, because of the lifestyle they've been afforded, because of the way they live their lives as top football players? Mm-hmm. Is it something that worried you as you were about to finish your career?
Oh yeah, definitely. You got to remember, from the age of 15, 16, you've been told what to do, when to do, how to do. And then they just kick you out.
There's no aftercare or anything?
Aftercare?
No.
No, nothing. You just go. And then they'll say, oh, go and get your badges. Well, I've had 21 years to try and get my badges. Why are you telling me now?
Yeah.
So that is one thing I would say to young players. If you can get your badges while you're playing, get them. Because you don't want to get to the end and then say, oh, yeah, go and get your badges. That's 3 years. That's 4 years.
Yeah, okay.
To get them when you've just had 15, 20 years doing it.
And there's nothing stopping you doing it.
No, you've got a lot of time on your hands in the afternoons.
Do you wish you had done that?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Is the adjustment from the routine mentally something difficult? Because it reminds me of, I come from a military town and a lot of people famously struggle coming out of the Navy into everyday life because it's so unregimented, so different. No one really knows who you are or whatever. Is that something you've had to live through, do you think?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's the like you said, unregimented. You're used to waking up at this time. You're used to doing this at this time, breakfast, and then going to doing this and then here, and then going to do that then. Then you've got this time to do this. Now you've got all this time and you don't know where to do anything.
Yeah.
You've got a schedule.
Yeah.
We used to have a schedule at Liverpool for, I think, about a month, 2 months.
In advance?
Yeah. Now you don't even know what you're doing there tomorrow.
Did you like that regimentation in your playing?
I've grown up in it.
Yeah.
And that's all I know. So, it was difficult. The first year I come out of Bolton, I trained at a local club, Edgerton, where a friend of mine was training. He said, come down. I'm like, all right, let me come down. And I loved it. Because it gave me that little environment that I'd used to being in. I could go there. We got there about 9:30, train.
Was it easy to train in?
It was ex-players, some ex-players.
Okay.
Yeah, and some younger lads. So okay. It was good. It was good fun.
Yeah.
We've had
some players in here. We had Chris in here. I mentioned Kirkland. We had Nigel Winterburn in here as well, who still, I think he's in his mid-50s now. He still plays quite regularly because he wants that. And Chris Kirkland, I mean, I don't want to talk, put words in his mouth. He gave an interview shortly after I spoke to him as well, where he said it's the high of playing and the adrenaline you get from that, and you can get through it because you know you've got another game coming. But when you come to the end of your career, it's very difficult to not get down and to not have these mental health issues because you think, as you've said, what am I doing now? Where's the next kind of thing coming from to lift yourself for it?
And then as well, football will tell you not to do anything while you're in football.
Right, because then what you focus on football.
Yeah, so for argument's sake, this. There's nothing wrong with doing this in the afternoon, talking with your mates or talking about certain things. They wouldn't want you to do that.
Yeah.
But this is probably a respite from overthinking football.
Yeah, okay.
But you're not allowed to do that. We had Gerard Houllier. Gerard Houllier's funny one was, don't go shopping with your family.
Yeah, okay.
Just walking around and pushing trolleys. He wants you to totally rest.
He wouldn't even want you pushing a trolley. So that essentially, if you're talking, I mean, I don't want to go too far here, but you're talking about when you finish football, They push you away. I dare say if you've got a career-ending injury, you'd be off. You've said already today that if they decide they want to sign someone else in your position, you're gone. I know you're not trying to criticise individual people, but that's just the nature of how the industry is.
Oh, yeah.
So you're essentially like a piece of meat, basically.
Yeah, we all are, though.
Yeah, but I think in other jobs, Emil, that people would probably think a bit more about how it affects you personally, about what your life's happening, what's going on, what you need, other than just goals.
The thing is, if you're doing well, you're wanted. If you're not doing well, they're going to say, okay, well, we'll try and get you somewhere else. Or, yeah. But off you go. So.
And that's in any job, you think? It's just life?
I'm guessing it'll, but it's life, isn't it? Really. But in football, you know, they're not going to just keep you around because they like you.
No, true. But I just wonder if I mean, I've heard so many stories of not necessarily just in here, but just generally of players who maybe had to retire early. I'll tell you, Matt Murray, I don't know if you know Matt, he talked a bit about, he felt cheated because he had this knee injury, he was in the prime of his career, all the things he had been promised he would go on to achieve, he was not able to do that. And that's a huge mental adjustment for a young man. You know, it's difficult to do that. Yeah. And I don't know how much support he got from, he was at Wolves at the time, but it seems to me we need to maybe work a bit harder to look after people.
Yeah, I think there's several players that have been down there. We had one at Bolton, he had an ankle problem.
Mm.
Had several operations and ended up having to leave football.
Mm.
And that was, you've got to think about yourself as well, because he might not be able to walk. He might not be able to walk properly or go to the park with his kids and stuff like that.
So you've got to think about his quality of life.
Yeah, yeah. After. So I don't know what Bolton's aftercare was with him. I don't know if it was good or bad. I don't know.
Mm. But it's got to be thought about. Because I wonder if it's partly to do with the fact that it's such a macho world. We talked earlier, didn't we, about how mature and how strong you've got to be, whether you're just expected to just get on with it.
Yeah, deal with it at times. And I look at, when I speak about it in my book, when I left Leicester to go to Liverpool, I struggled the mental side of it off the field.
Because you were living in a different city.
Yeah, okay. And I just couldn't deal with that. I had all my support mechanisms back in Leicester.
Yeah.
Mates, parents, aunties, uncles, whoever. I had it all there. Then I'm going to this new city, which I don't know anyone. And this is before, it sounds stupid, but this is before the everything you have on your phones.
Mobile phones and stuff, yeah.
So yeah, well, phones were there.
But you couldn't keep in touch as easily.
No, and not everyone had a phone, you know, and they didn't have Google, you didn't have Google and all that.
No.
Going finding things, and it was just tough at first. And like you're saying, it's about growing up. I had to grow up very quickly.
How old were you at the time?
22.
So you're a young man.
I mean, well, you say that, a young man, but I'm 22. You'd have thought that I'd have grown up quicker than that, especially playing in football from the age of 16, 17.
Are you surprised that Liverpool didn't take more of an interest in how you're getting on, or did they?
They did, in a sense that they had player liaisons. In my mind, player liaison was for the foreign lads.
Okay.
And they're coming from abroad, but they're bringing everyone over with them to help them with that. And I'm just down the road. But I never told anyone that I needed help.
Yeah.
In that sense. But it made me grow up very quickly. And I know lads that are coming, and I spoke to lads that are coming, that are moving clubs at 15.
Yeah.
I said, how'd you deal with that?
Yeah. It's young, very, very young. Too young.
Oh, no.
Too young.
Too young for me.
And fans won't make the connection, will they, between how you're getting on in your personal life and how you're performing on the pitch? Because they are linked, aren't they? But fans don't think about that, do they?
No, they don't. They don't. My only thing was I got a respite from that, being at the training ground, being on the pitch.
Hmm.
That gave me that joy.
A bit of downtime and everything. Yeah. How do you look back on your career, Emil? You're very proud of what you achieved. Any regrets or anything you would do differently?
No, the only thing is when I left Liverpool that year, they won the Champions League.
Yeah. Okay.
So
that's a regret.
Well, I wouldn't say it's just something that, you know, niggles at you a little bit. But if I had a stage, you never know if they'd won it.
You won just about every other cup.
Yeah.
So it can't be all bad. Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us today. People should go out and read your book, Even Heskey Scored. How did you come up with the title? Was it your idea?
Mine and the co-writer.
Good for you.
Ghostwriter.
Brilliant. I think it's one of the best autobiography titles out there. So good for you. Thank you so much. People should go out and buy that book. It's available now. It's well worth reading it. And we thank Emil for being part of Ramble Meets. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Amy. Emil Heskey, former Leicester, Liverpool, Birmingham, Wigan, Who else?
England?
Yeah. I was trying to remember all the clubs.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Emil Heskey, former England, Leicester, Liverpool, Wigan, Birmingham, Villa. I've got that in the wrong order.
Yeah, doesn't matter. Newcastle, Jets and Bolton.
No, let's
perfect.
Do it again.
You want to do it again? All right, cool. Let's do it again.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit. And he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.